Obama people. I said Obama people.
I thought the donkey ears were kind of cute, and I, you know, I am a Democrat, so it's something that I would go for.
Pajama people. Pajama people.
By carrying, like, little things like a everyday coffee cup will show the voters' dedication.
They sure do make you sleepy with the things they might say.
Obama people, coffee cups, donkey hats. In the last days of the campaign, everybody's drinking their last Kool-Aid and thinking about Halloween. Think of it. Little Obama's coming to your door asking for donations. Trick or treat.
Oy, oy, oy.
It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, October 30th, and I'm trying to visualize all those little Obamas.
Little Obamas coming to the door. Obama people. I've been trying to use that Frank Zappa for like the last 2 years.
Well, you got it in style.
Yes, before the campaign ended. Good morning, Adora.
And today we're going to talk to some folks who have already voted. America's exit poll is open. Plus, picking the president using your morning coffee. We're going to explain that. Those stories are coming up, but first we have headlines.
Somebody's doing something right. It's a strong day for world markets. European indices are up. Asian markets are closed after a huge day. South Korea's key index was up a record 12%. Japan and Hong Kong markets also posted double-digit gains. Wall Street opens later this morning, and futures trading there points to a positive opening, perhaps around 3%. Yesterday, the Dow and S&P both lost about 1%. The Dow closed at 89.90, and the S&P finished at 930. There will be some fresh data for traders to chew on a little later this hour. The latest GDP numbers are on the way, along with the latest unemployment data.
John, national polls show a tight presidential race in Florida. Both candidates are spending plenty of time there. Here's John McCain yesterday in Tampa.
Barack Obama has displayed some impressive qualities. But the question is whether this is a man who has what it takes to protect America from Osama bin Laden, Al-Qaeda, and other grave threats in the world.
Barack Obama was also in Florida with a special guest.
In case all of you forgot, this is what it's like to have a great president.
Obama was referring to Bill Clinton, who shared the stage with him for the first time during this presidential cycle.
If you lived in Philadelphia, it was a generational moment yesterday.
The 0-2 pitch, swing and a miss, struck him out. The Philadelphia Phillies are 2008 World Champions of Baseball.
And that hasn't happened since the Phillies won the World Series back in 1980. The Phillies ended their drought, winning the series 4-1, 4-3 last night after a 46-hour rain delay. But we've had a 2-year political delay. Lame duck Bush era is about to be over, and the new president will take office. We want a slogan for this campaign, for this 2-year campaign. 2008, we've been getting some great lines on the website.
I
and
have
at 877-8 my take. Yes, please.
Is this the beginning or the end?
Is this the beginning or the end? That's from Adora Udoji. You can actually vote for hers on our website at mytake.
No, I like to come up with a better one if they're going to actually vote. But anyhow, we want to hear your thoughts. 877-8-MY-TAKE, a slogan for this presidential cycle.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Brian writes on our website, this is his catchphrase for the election, the campaign is over. Pain, P-A-I-N. We want your slogans here. And it's also because of America's exit poll is open and has been open for weeks. For some of you, the campaign's already over. You've already voted. It's estimated that as many as 30% of Americans will have voted in early voting by the time Election Day rolls around. And that's why we're conducting America's exit poll, talking to actual voters. And they're open in Tennessee. And from Franklin, Tennessee, Justin Pitt joins us. Justin, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. And from Martin, Tennessee, Magdalene Hampton joins us. How are you, Magdalene?
I'm good. How are you?
All right. So what was it like voting, Justin?
It was actually pretty quick. Only about 12 people voting. Got in, got right out. It was pretty easy.
Why did you decide to vote early?
I usually like to volunteer on Election Day. So it's a good way for me to get it out of the way and then be available on Election Day to volunteer and poll watch and do that sort of thing.
And we've heard from a lot of people who are busy on Election Day who want to vote early to get it out of the way. Magdalene, why did you vote early?
Well, I voted early because I'll be working at the poll on Election Day and also just get it out of the way also.
Now, in your precinct where you were, Justin, did you have a sense of how people are voting, how it was swinging one way or another?
My county is a pretty Republican county, so we will vote Republican. But it was really neat when I went to vote, the 12 or so people that were voting, it really was people from all walks of life, and it was a pretty good cross-section.
Magdalene, set the scene for me really quick.
Well, we usually vote Democrat in this county.
Right. And more than normal, a lot of people, different people than you've ever seen before?
No, there were only three people ahead
only
of
three.
Line.
All right. Well, Magdalene, who did you vote for?
Obama.
And Justin, who did you vote for?
Senator McCain.
Justin Pitt from Franklin, Tennessee, and Magdalene Hampton from Martin, Tennessee. America's Exit Poll. Early
That's
voter.
Tennessee, and now we're going to head to Florida.
When he picked her as a running mate, I said, forget it.
And what was the deciding factor for you?
I was afraid of waking up one morning and hearing President Palin.
That's it. It's not his fault, and I think that he would be ahead in the polls if he wasn't taking all the blame for the condition that we're in.
More voices from Americans that have already voted. Those in Florida, where both presidential candidates have been campaigning hard. Both Barack Obama and John McCain have been spending a lot of time there as the days wind down. Takeaway political director Andrea Bernstein is also there. She joins us from West Palm Beach, one of our counties that count. Hello there, Andrea. And boy, a big night last night with Obama and Bill Clinton together on one stage.
That's right. Good morning, Adora. You know, it was sort of like a coming home of sorts because, you know, Bill Clinton and Barack Obama have certainly had their difficulties. It was their first joint appearance. It was a huge one, 20,000 people. Compare that to the 1,000 people that McCain had earlier in Miami. And as a matter of fact, he was right here in Palm Beach County where I am visiting business leaders where just about 50 people were there. Not usually the kind of event that a candidate is having on the last day of an election. What they want to be doing is driving people to go to the polls for this early voting. However, there are lots of people at the polls. What a scene. People are waiting in line for hours. They're driving their cars around the parking lot trying to find traffic spots. Tempers are getting a little frayed. But what's interesting is that the voting statistics put out by the state say the Democrats have 160,000 vote edge. And it's certainly reflected by what I'm seeing. I mean, in the early voting, I was just over at Howley's restaurant, and a couple said everyone online was for Obama. Now, this is a wealthy county. Obviously, there are people here who are very big McCain supporters, but that is not necessarily who's coming out for the early voting.
So why is Palm Beach County a county that counts?
Well, it is heavily Democratic. It's more Democratic than some of the counties we've been to, voted 60-40 for Kerry, for example. But almost half of the population of Florida Jews live here. It's about the third biggest county in the state, and there was a big concern early on because a lot of the people here say that they've been getting these whispering campaign emails. Obama was a pro-Palestinian. He was anti-Semitic. He was no friend to Israel. And some of that is lingering today, even with a voter who I met yesterday, Sandra Bentley, who said that she did vote for Obama.
I still have reservations because of the Reverend Wright thing. 20 years in somebody's church, and to listen to me had to reveal some of his beliefs. So that's the main thing that bothers me about him.
Something made you set that aside, though. What was that?
I just do not like anything about McCain.
What kind of concern was it for the Obama campaign that potentially some Jewish voters were going to defect?
It was a really big concern because there was a sense early on that this might be a Democratic constituency that would switch to McCain. Lots of people told me they were thinking about it until he selected Sarah Palin. Hillary Clinton has been down in Palm Beach County talking to voters here. And remember, because there was no primary, Obama never got to introduce himself, and that has all happened in the general election campaign. Listen to what Abe Goldstein told me. He was at Poppy's restaurant in Delhi eating the early bird special. He sort of gives a sense of the arc of the Florida campaign for Jews.
There was a lot of bad publicity at the beginning, and you don't know really who to believe. And they were trying to say he was a Muslim, which isn't so terrible, but they're trying to make you think, well, he'd be anti-Semitic if he's a Muslim. I got a lot of email about it. It put thoughts in my head, you know, because I've been a Democrat all my life, and I was saying, I'd hate to have to go Republican. But the more you read, the more you realize that you can't believe anything anybody's saying.
As you mentioned, Andrea, the polls are very tight in Florida, neck and neck, actually. So where's the support for McCain, and how is he winning over some voters?
Well, there clearly are a lot of Republicans in this state that, in fact, it was considered to be off the table for Obama for a long time. But there certainly is a very active conversation going on within the Jewish community about whether Barack Obama is a friend to Israel. Somebody I met had gone into the library yesterday where the voting was taking place to get Obama's book because someone had told him that it would prove that Obama was an anti-Semite. He wasn't so sure, but he voted for Obama anyway. But there was a couple that I spoke to outside the JCC Senior Center in Boca Raton, and you can hear that certainly some of this concern that's been spread is taking hold.
A lot of people are voting for him because he is black.
Yeah, like blacks
but
are voting for him.
I don't vote black. Think that way at
no,
all.
No, I don't either.
No.
I know. As I told my rabbi just now, they asked us that in the class in our group. They asked me, they said, one of the women asked me, she says, are you not voting for him because he's black? And I said, if it was Colin Powell, I'd vote for him in a second. It has nothing to do with color. I don't trust him, I don't know him, and I don't like his wife.
Andrea, they sound like they're in a lush car, like a Cadillac down there in Florida.
Yeah. They were in a car. They weren't so interested in speaking to me, but I was persistent. What's fascinating, though, is that Obama's run $28 million worth of advertising here to McCain's $8 million.
Wow.
And it's generated some fear on some issues like McCain wants to take away your Medicare. He said no such thing, but the Obama people are pushing that. And you can hear from people like Nat Vogel and Danny Morrow, also at Poppy's, that some of that concern has taken hold, too.
I don't like the idea of him wanting to do away with Social Security and also with Medicare.
You think McCain wants to do away with Medicare?
He says that he would give everybody $2,500, towards medicine or doctors, whatever, and do away with Medicare.
Just imagine if we took Bush's, that he wanted to privatize Social Security, where would everybody be today?
Had they actually voted, Andrea?
Yes. So many people have actually voted. I mean, everybody here does seem to be voting. The crowds are amazing. One of the things that the governor actually opened up the polls for longer hours because so many people were voting, getting some criticism from his own party for it. Now, I do want to say the state is very hotly fought. Today I'm going off to Hillsborough County over in Tampa, home of the World Series losers. It's
wear black. Be sure to wear black.
He won the Florida primary that essentially ended the Republican contest, and he gave his victory speech there. So it's clearly a place friendly to Republicans, and we're going to see what they're thinking today.
Andrea Bernstein, many, many thanks to you.
Thank you.
Andrea Bernstein, the Takeaway political director, on her way to gather more intelligence on what Floridians are thinking about as they go to the polls.
It's interesting. The counties that count, you sort of hear people's conflicts. I mean, a lot of those voters don't particularly like Barack Obama, but really are disillusioned by the Republicans. Very interesting.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Think back now. What a campaign it's been. Remember Huckabee? Remember the Iraq War as the central issue? Hillary versus Barack? All those primaries? How do you sum up something that was 2 years in the making and is about to end? We want your slogan for the 2008 presidential campaign. We're getting some great lines. They're all on our website. Tell us yours at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email it to us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
John, in this last leg of the presidential campaign, Iran has gotten little attention. U.S. foreign policy for nearly 30 years has been trying to isolate the country, today trying to prevent Iran from developing nuclear technology and funding terrorist activities. Despite hundreds of millions of dollars in intelligence efforts and years of sanctions, the United States and the international community has struggled. But a plan hatched 2 years ago by a minor undersecretary in the Treasury Department to target Iran's banks today is having a serious impact. Robin Wright tells the story in her article, Stuart Levy's War, in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine. Welcome, Robin.
Good morning.
Tell us about Stuart Levy's little idea.
Well, Stuart Levy was having breakfast in Bahrain and noticed a headline in a local paper that a major Swiss bank had cut off business with Iran. And it gave him an idea to try to tap the private sector for the first time to widen the sanctions effort. Governments traditionally tap their own actions. They're limited in their own bailiwick to try to squeeze a country financially. And so he began a campaign to get the world's major financial institutions to stop doing business with certain Iranian banks that were linked with financing parts, military and other branches of government that were associated with weapons of mass destruction, particularly missile programs, nuclear technology, facilitating funding for terrorism groups. Mm-hmm. And this has had a very unusual impact.
Well, he certainly gave a new meaning to follow the money. Do you want to lay out the challenges and why Dubai has been key to the latest developments?
Well, Dubai is the big hole in the U.S. effort. There are now more than 80 international financial institutions that have cut off business with Iran's major banks, and this has had an extraordinary impact. But what's happened is that many of Iran's businesses and banks have simply started doing business through Dubai, one of the seven emirates in the United Arab Emirates that's just across the water, the Persian Gulf waters, from Iran. And that has given them an outlet. So, for example, people who import to Iran will and haven't been able to do business because their banks have been sanctioned, have moved to Dubai, opened local bank accounts, imported goods to Dubai, and once they get there, they turn them around and just reship them to Iran. That's one of the many ways that Dubai is being used.
Well, does that end up nullifying the entire program? And I guess what surprises me most about your article, Robin, is with all the frozen assets that we're talking about in the policies of U.S. sanctions against Iran, that this hasn't been tried before.
It is very interesting, isn't it? But again, it's usually governments are limited to the leverage they have. And this involved not only going to other governments and saying, look, we want to talk to your banks. And a lot of governments were very annoyed or suspicious about what U.S. intentions were. And then convincing the banks themselves. And it took several visits. Stuart Levy has done dozens of visits around the world to talk to institutions to try to lay out a plan that your banking is only as reputable as your clientele's practices. And
that's, you know, what did it? That's what encouraged the cooperation that the Treasury Department is seeing now with, 80 countries?
more than 80 financial institutions. What's really surprising is that there are so many banks in Muslim countries such as Bahrain and Malaysia, as well as China, which has become a major importer of Iranian oil. But as China wants to be part of global financial institutions, it has to meet certain standards. And so the United States has not only convinced major banks, but also convinced the International Financial Watchdog based in Paris, the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, which includes the world's 30 largest economies, to warn Iran and warn about doing business with Iran. Right. And this has had a rippling effect.
So the leverage is clear, but it's also clear inside Iran, Stuart Levy has had an effect because he's described as this, you know, wild Zionist demon traveling the world trying to thwart Iran at every turn. That's an indication that the Iranians have paid attention here.
It also comes at a time that Iran's own economy is in real trouble. President Ahmadinejad has engaged in some populist policies that have backfired. He mandated, for example, Iran's banks to lower their interest rates to 10 to 12% at a time that its own central bank was warning against it because inflation was officially pegged at 30% and believed to be higher. And produce has tripled in prices in the last couple of years. Iranians gripe that housing prices have doubled. As we live through our own banking crisis, you can begin to see more clearly why this kind of program actually might have an impact. Now, it's not going to do anything overnight, but it's certainly done more probably than any single thing we've done over the past 30 years.
Robin Wright is a writer for the New York Times Magazine. Thank you. And she certainly writes about some of the potential downsides of the policy. And you can read her article, Stuart Levy's War, in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine. And now we have Femi Okeh with the latest headlines.
And the time is 28 minutes past the hour. Several people were injured today when a car bomb exploded near a university in northern Spain. Police arrested several Baath separatists 2 days ago for planning an attack. Hundreds have been killed in the Baath separatists' decades-long struggle for independence. And at least 50 people are dead after a series of bombs went off in cities across northeastern India earlier today. Dozens of militant separatist groups are active in the region, although no one's taken responsibilities for the attacks yet. Just getting in some eyewitness accounts. The eyewitnesses are saying from this bombing and series of bombings that cars have been burnt out. They're seeing dead bodies on the floor and the fire brigade having trouble getting towards the cars to actually deal with the bombings there. Barack Obama campaigned for the first time with Bill Clinton in Florida last night. The same night, a 30-minute Obama infomercial appeared on major TV networks. John McCain called it a feel-good commercial paid for, and I quote here, with broken promises. Congolese General Laurent Nkunda says he's ready to negotiate with the government. He's been fighting their troops while leading rebel forces towards eastern Congo's capital. The UN is urging him to enforce a ceasefire. And Syrian riot police surrounded the U.S. embassy in Damascus this morning. Security concerns were high as tens of thousands of people gathered to protest a deadly U.S. raid near the Iraqi border. U.S. officials say the attack was targeting a top al-Qaeda operative.
That sounds like that's not going away. That's getting out of hand.
Yeah, Syria's really upset, mainly because they're getting very little information from the U.S. about why they would be on Syrian territory.
Also, there's precedent in Syria for orchestrating demonstrations of that type as well. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Quick look at some economic statistics. The gross domestic product statistic has just been released for the third quarter, showing a shrinkage in the economy, but probably smaller than expected. The markets are reacting very, very positively to that, at least in the futures on the S&P and the Dow Jones Industrial Average. Also, weekly jobless claims are essentially unchanged, both sort of marginally, guardedly positive numbers on the economy, and the markets are reacting positively. Here's a slogan for the campaign. How about enough with the polls already? I mean, you've got secret polls, tracking polls, scientific polls throughout this election cycle. But what about polls where people like to participate rather than being interrupted at home by pollsters? You know, there are alternative polls all throughout the U.S. that tend to reflect the views of unscientific special communities. But hey, they're all Americans. Maybe they vote, maybe they don't, but they have a voice, too. And to test the voices of some of these alternative polls, we sent our culture correspondent, Mary Beth Williams, to take a look at some places where they are taking the pulse of America in unusual ways. Mary Beth Williams is also the host of Table Talk on Salat.com. Mary Beth, what sort of polling experiences did you find out there?
Well, good morning. Yeah, absolutely. What's our favorite way to vote in America? It's with our wallets. There and so go. That's what we've been doing this election. There are a variety of ways we can express what candidate we're supporting and also maybe get something delicious out of the deal as well.
So you went around to retail establishments.
Absolutely. Well, there are a bunch of polls you can take online and out in the field. The Retail Bakers of America, it's their second time around with a poll. Obama is winning 58% to 42%. You can get either an Obama cookie or a McCain cookie. They accurately predicted the last election for Bush. You can go on Domino's. Domino's has a poll. It's for the candidates and also what your favorite sandwich is as well. Hmm. Obama is winning that 53% to 34%. Second Life just did a poll in September. It was conducted by an avatar, Andy Evans, who's a researcher for the Social Research Foundation. Mm-hmm. Obama won that by more than double over McCain. But if it's the day before Halloween.
All right. And the outcome is one measure, but right. Also the extent to which people really want to participate is the other thing. Who did you meet along the way here?
Well, you know what? Yeah, if you're gonna get out there, I think a cookie or a mask or something. I went to Party City. Now, if imitation is the sincerest form of flattery.
What's Party City?
Party City is your costume and party supply hookup.
Great.
I went out there. You can get an Obama mask or a McCain mask. Obama is leading in the sales 3-1.
Wow.
Over McCain. And traditionally, whomever sells the most Halloween masks is the victor in the elections. And I want you to listen to Rebecca. I met her at Party City where she was shopping for her costume. And here's what she had to say.
I thought the donkey ears were kind of cute. And I am a Democrat, so it's something that I would go for, opposed to wearing a Barack mask.
If somebody came to your door wearing a McCain mask, what would you do?
It would scare the crap out of me.
You know, listen to how earnest she is. And a lot of people at the Party City weren't necessarily into the whole mask business.
Right. I want you to listen to Anthony. Anthony works there. He has been watching this for weeks and weeks, and he's going to be voting in his very first election on Tuesday, and he takes this very seriously. Listen to Anthony.
If you're buying it for the right reasons, for, you know, the political reasons, then I think it's okay. But if you're just buying it to make fun, I don't think you should make fun of either one of them. You know, one of them are going to be our future president. I think that's something we should take very seriously.
Ernest Anthony at Party City.
Anthony, for bringing the party on. But there are other ways of prognosticating the race. 7-11, this is going to be their third 7-11.
How does it work?
You can vote with your coffee cup. You can go into any 7-11 and you can get your coffee in a blue Obama cup or a red McCain cup.
It's like Iraq, where you get your thumb stamp.
And that is, it's got to be more accurate than a lot of the voting booths around America right now. Your vote is tabulated instantly. The 7-11, this is their third. The last two elections, they came within fractions of percentage points of calling the election. 7-11 sells a million cups of coffee every day.
Wow. So what does a coffee voter sound like?
I went into 7-Eleven and I watched people beelining for those cups. I want you to listen to two of the people who were there getting their fix in the morning.
By carrying like little things like a everyday coffee cup will show the voters' dedication. And they'll see that there's actually people who are willing to vote for Obama. It's not just a hearsay.
Give me the cup. I'm going to put the coffee onto the blue one. I'm sorry. This is Obama? Hey! Excuse me, I'm going to take a sip. Very good coffee. Now it tastes better when it's in a blue cup.
Perfect. It's better in blue.
It's
yes,
better
indeed.
In blue. Joe, the appropriately named Joe came in the morning, and he got his coffee in a regular cup, and then when he saw that he had a choice, poured his coffee out and put it into an Obama cup. Obama is winning in this race 60% to 40%.
Wow.
He's beating McCain in every state except North Carolina. He's even beating McCain in Arizona.
Wow, it's great that you've got it broken down. Now, these people sound like they're likely voters, but there are people that are polled in some of the things you looked at who aren't going to be voting at all.
Right. I mean, it's interesting that you mentioned that because, the people who are participating in this, I mean, in the Domino's race, 85% of the people who participated in the Domino's poll said that they were going to be voting on Tuesday. You know, the last election, we only had 60% voter turnout. So so it says something about who...
Oh, so
who,
people who don't go to Domino's aren't patriotic Americans.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. Real
Americans. Thank you, Sarah Palin. Thank you. So tell us about the Scholastic poll of young people.
Yeah, these are people who can't vote at all, but they're going to be voting in a few years, and they have a lot to say about this election. Scholastic magazines have been running an election poll every presidential election since 1940.
Wow.
They've only been wrong twice. They conducted their poll throughout the magazines in September and October. Their results are in as well. 57% for Obama, 39% for McCain, and 4% undecided. This was a poll of kids kindergarten through 12th grade, and I spoke to one of Scholastic's reporters, Leah Ferran. She is a high school freshman, and here's what she had to say.
I've heard of kids having debates with their parents on, you know, who they think should vote. And of course, I think of course it has, you know, an effect on them. Because if the kid is with their parent almost 24/7, you know, or a majority of the time, they're going to have an influence and vice versa. I mean, it really is a give and take thing.
Young little freshman pundit there. So the Scholastic poll since 1940 has been wrong only twice. When was it wrong quickly?
It was wrong Dewey over Truman, which was a tight one, and Kennedy over Nixon.
Mary Elizabeth Williams, thanks so much for coming in. Mary Elizabeth Williams is the Takeaway's culture correspondent and host of Table Talk at Salon.com, looking at some alternative polls. And now, mainstream headlines from Femi Okeng.
Thanks very much. The time is 20 minutes to the top of the hour. Just getting in the jobless claims figures. They remain at a high level, 479,000, the same as last week. All European indices are showing gains today. It was a good day in Asia as well. All these positive markets follow a Fed rate cut yesterday of 0.5%. The death toll has risen from a roadside bomb explosion in eastern Baghdad. Six people are dead after a blast went off near a stall selling ice cream. And elsewhere in the city, another car bomb killed one person earlier today. A quick look at some of the headlines making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And around the world, all financial institutions have had to be re-examined in light of the financial collapse, which some say is ongoing, even though markets are bouncing back significantly today. The International Monetary Fund is one of those institutions. It's announced a new lending facility to help emerging market countries cope with the global financial and liquidity crisis. Maria Ramirez, a global economist and market strategist, has this to say about the urgency of what the IMF needs to do now.
There is an urgent infusion of liquidity that's needed in many of those markets. And the IMF, I think, as well as the Fed and all the central banks have been all working together to injecting liquidity in the global financial system.
Getting the financial system to be more liquid is the challenge. Andrew Walker, BBC Economics editor, joins us now from London. The IMF is going to try to support emerging markets here, Andrew, but I'm wondering if they have the resources to do this for an extended period of time, if countries like Brazil and Hungary and Pakistan are maybe interested in tapping into the IMF.
Yeah, it's an important question. I mean, certainly the IMF has the resources to make a fairly hefty start on this kind of exercise. They, a couple of weeks ago, they were in a position where they had immediate access to about $200 billion worth of funds for lending. And there are a couple of borrowing arrangements that they have with some of the bigger, more cash-rich of their member countries, which would add another $50 billion or so to that. So, you know, for the immediate future, the funds are certainly there. But if you look at the scale of the potential problem, you have to wonder whether it will be enough. The just before I came to the studio, actually, I saw one of the news agencies reporting that the IMF's managing director, Dominic Strauss-Kahn, was saying that actually they do need more funds. Mm. And when you look at the kind of things that they've been doing just over the last couple of weeks, already three agreements in place with, or more or less in place with Iceland, Hungary and Ukraine, that's already accounted for $30 billion. So, yeah, wow. They may well need more.
Now, we've always thought of the IMF as a safety net for the world financial system, but has it always been a safety net purely for emerging markets?
No, certainly not. And it is actually the case, of course, that Iceland went to the IMF just a couple of weeks ago. That was the first time that a developed economy had borrowed since the 1970s, but developed economies, if you go back that far, have done it on a number of occasions. That most recent one was Britain, when we had a currency crisis here. That was the IMF then came in with rescue loans, and there was a very acrimonious political argument about public spending cuts. But before that, there had been a number of occasions when developed economies had borrowed from the IMF. The very first country ever to borrow from the IMF was France, although I suppose you could argue about just how developed an economy it was back then in the early days after the Second World War.
Well, we've got to go, but quickly, it does seem as though the IMF's depleted resources and the sort of scale of this financial crisis has become an argument for really thinking seriously about a global financial institution that is capable of being a backstop, yes?
Absolutely right. And I think one of the debates that's going to happen at the summit we've got coming up in Washington in a couple of weeks' time will be about precisely that kind of thing and whether an enlarged IMF might possibly be the way to go about doing it.
A safety net for the world's financial system. Andrew Walker, very interesting. A BBC economics editor speaking with us from London. Thank you, Andrew.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. It's Thursday. It's October 30th. It's the day before Halloween. What are you going to dress up as tomorrow, huh?
I don't know. I think I'll just be the chaperone for my four kids. We've got Pippi Longstocking, we've got Grim Reaper, we've got Indiana Jones, and we've got my oldest daughter is going as the stock market crash, which is a good segue to headlines from Femi Okay.
Thank you very much. The time is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Now, we've got some brand new numbers, and they could move the markets when Wall Street opens in just over half an hour. The U.S. economy shrunk in the third quarter by 0.3%, and this from new GDP numbers. It's the worst showing since the late 2001. And also new this morning, jobless claims, they stayed about the same for last week as they were for this week. Dozens are dead and hundreds more injured after a string of coordinated bombings in northeast India. And police fear that more bombs are on the way. The blast happened in spots around the region. The area is known for militants and ethnic clashes. Somali investigators have a suspect in custody in yesterday's wave of suicide attacks that killed more than 20 people. Authorities have an Islamic cleric under arrest. Riot police surrounded the American embassy in Syria to protect it from tens of thousands of government-organized protesters, and they were protesting a U.S. attack on Syria near the Iraqi border. The demonstration ended peacefully. American troops were targeting what's thought to be the base of a smuggling network getting foreign fighters into Iraq. And last night, Senator John McCain appeared on Larry King's show. He talked about race and talked about how he didn't think it was a factor in the upcoming general election.
There's racism in America. We all know that because we can't stop working against it. But I am totally convinced that 99 and 44/100 percent of the American people are going to make a decision on who's best to lead this country.
That was a very serious comment on race. And then Senator Obama was on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. Jon Stewart asked him, was there any confusion about being partly white and partly black when it came to voting?
Are you concerned that you may go into the voting booth and...
I won't know what to do.
Your white half will all of a sudden decide, I can't do this.
Yeah, it's a problem.
It was a good sport. That's Senator Obama on The Daily Show last night with Jon Stewart.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
And we're going to continue with Barack Obama. Last night, he ran a 30-minute campaign commercial on four networks during primetime television.
I will not be a perfect president. But I can promise you this. I will always tell you what I think and where I stand.
The $3 million worth of advertising is the ultimate reflection of Senator Obama's spending flexibility. Senator McCain, with far less money in the bank, can't compete on that level. That's great for Obama, but what about campaign finance reform? Richard Brefault, a professor at Columbia Law School, joins us now. He's writing a book on campaign finance laws. Good morning.
Good morning.
According to reports, Obama has raised in the neighborhood of somewhere around $650 million. For this presidential run. Has he rewritten the playbook?
He has, or at least he's added a new chapter, that's for sure. Not only has he raised a record amount, but he has actually raised record amounts in relatively small contributions. This is something that finance reformers have talked about really going back almost to the beginning of the 20th century is one way of reducing dependence on large contributions is to getting very large numbers of small donors. And it appears that he's managed to do that. Not his whole campaign, but he has raised far more in small donations than anybody's ever done before.
So does that define public campaigning differently? Let's look at September. $150 million he raised, according to his campaign, from 600,000 donors who gave an average of $86. Isn't that a reflection of democracy?
It is. I mean, Obama said, I think, back in April when he decided not to take public funding in the general election, that he'd already had a lot of success in raising small donations, and he called it a parallel form of public finance. Not exactly, but it's close. I mean, it has many of the benefits of public financing, in particular the reduced dependency on big donors. I mean, this is certainly true. A couple of questions. One is it's not entirely dependent on small donors. He's had a lot of big donors, and he has a lot of what are called bundlers, people who help him pull in big contributions from other people. And, I mean, in some ways, the big question for the future of public funding is he unique? Will others be able to replicate this, or is there something special about him and special about this election that enabled him to do it?
Well, Professor Brefault, it's possible that maybe the lesson here is that regulation does work in some sense, because without the laws on the books that require a kind of breakout of maximum contributions, small contributions, the regulations of how people contribute, we wouldn't necessarily know the scale of the small contributors that make this kind of democratic statement of Barack Obama. So maybe that, rather than the amount, is more where the regulation should go in the future.
Well, there's something to that. I mean, certainly we know a lot more about campaign finance now and over the last 30 years than we did before that. That is certainly one of the successes of the campaign finance laws adopted in the wake of Watergate is just have a lot more knowledge. Although it's interesting, one of the criticisms that Obama's campaign has gotten from the McCain campaign is the lack of disclosure about the small donors. Under the law, donations under $200 are basically exempt from disclosure. The assumption is that small donors don't pose the kinds of dangers, so there's less need to know about them. And I think questions have been raised about who exactly are the small donors, where are they from. I'm not sure that that's a serious concern, but That question has been raised. Do we need to know more about even the small givers? I'm not sure I buy that, but some people are making that point.
Well, what's the abuse potential there, if you could play it out? I mean,
well, there's
a bunch of people from Bangladesh,
I mean,
or something, or a bunch of kids from Dubai, you know?
Well, I mean, one is there could be foreign donations. I think the Obama campaign says they put in controls on that, but no controls are perfect. The other is it is possible that you could try and run large donations into small ones. And one thing is that, in fact, really we don't really know how many individual donors there have been, because I think when people talk about the $150 million, say, in small donations, we haven't really figured out whether you can accumulate them, whether somebody gives $200 in, $100 in March, $100 again in April, $100 again in May, $100 again in June, et cetera. That's going to show up as a lot of $100 donations. And I think it's going to take time to go through the 3.1 million donations and see how many of them were repeat donations, which put people who start out small above that small
and
threshold.
And that's another whole issue about where the FEC, the Federal Election Commission, has been during this campaign and them set to go into action sometime next year. But let's talk about campaign finance reform. Is there a mockery element of what's gone on in this presidential election? What's wrong with public financing?
Well, there are two things going on, and maybe one thing is to set the backdrop, is to the amount of money we're talking about. The public grant in the general election is $84 million. That's basically based on $20 million that was decided on in 1974, and then it's been adjusted for inflation ever since. $20 million was actually pretty low even in 1974. If you remember, in 1972 we had an election, and Richard Nixon spent $60 million, and George McGovern spent $30 million. So what did Congress do? It took someone who lost by a wide margin did and cut that number further. So it really, the public grant has always been too small, and over time it's gotten smaller, because even though it's adjusted for inflation, the cost of campaigning have risen much faster than the general rate of inflation. So we really have campaigns that probably cost about $200 million or more, and the public grant is about $80 million. So there's been pressure on candidates at least since the 90s to come up with alternatives. So we saw the rise of soft money in the 1990s. That was one way around this. In the last election, 2004, people talked a lot about 527s, independent organizations.
Mm-hmm.
That's another way around it. Yet another way around it is to run a lot of money through the political parties. John McCain is only taking $84 million in public money, but the Republican Party is probably spending another $100 million in this race. So it's not as if he is totally disarmed. So one solution is to bring in money through other sources, through the parties, through friendly, technically independent organizations. The other is to do what Obama did, is to say, well, I'm going to just see if I can raise it on my own. One argument is that Obama has proved that public funding is unnecessary. Another argument is that he simply shown, he and McCain, if you take McCain and the Republican Party together, is that the public grant is inadequate and that something's got to be done. Private money's got to come in some way to make up for it.
All issues that are clearly going to be revisited as we look back at this campaign. Richard Brifault, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Professor Brifault is at Columbia Law School, and he's also writing a book on campaign finance law.
We can't stop talking about the election and its final week. How do you sum up something that's been 2 years in the making? Let's hear it.
Hi, my name is Mitchell. It's a two-part. It's the wait for 08, and if it is the landslide that we seem to be expecting, it's also the lead-up to the beat-up.
Landslide or not, call us with your slogan for this campaign, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Some of them are very clever. Very clever. I'm Adora Udoji.
I'm John Hockenberry. You can vote on them on our website. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
There's coffee, and then there's coffee in a blue cup.
Very good coffee. Now it tastes better when it's in a blue cup.
Beyond buttons and bumper stickers, branding. When you raise $500 million, business takes notice. Retail politics, it's actually retail in 08. Forget the movie. It's all about the plush on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, October 30th, and you were rather cryptically referring to some fun, really fun polls about
fun
the
polls,
election.
Yes. There are alternative polls. It's not clear if they're predictive, but they're definitely fun, including the 7-election poll where you either get blue coffee or red coffee and make your vote that way. Good morning, Adora.
The cups.
Yeah.
Blue cups,
that's right.
Red cups. And we're going to talk about that. But coming up also, what people abroad think of our presidential election. And is it the end of affirmative action, at least in two states? It's on the ballot. Those stories coming up. But first, these headlines.
Hard to believe, but the race is winding down. It's a tight Florida contest, according to John McCain, and he's going after an old punching bag.
I'll sit down and talk with one of the Castro brothers. I'll sit down with them right after they empty the political prison, right after they have free elections, right after the human rights organizations are functioning.
McCain talking to Cuban-American voters in Miami. Barack Obama also campaigned in Florida yesterday.
When you listen to Bill Clinton, you are reminded of what it's like to have a president who is engaged, who's passionate, who's smart, who reaches out, who's inclusive instead of divisive, who has energy, who has vision.
Yesterday's appearance was the first joint appearance of Barack Obama and Bill Clinton. Today on the trail, McCain moves to Ohio. Barack Obama spends more time in Florida before moving on to Virginia and Missouri.
In just under 30 minutes, Wall Street opens. Yesterday, the Dow and S&P both lost about 1%. Fresh data out this morning for the markets to chew. The U.S. economy shrunk in the third quarter by 0.3%. Also new this morning, jobless claims. They stayed about the same for the week. The Federal Reserve cut interest rates yesterday. The rate's now at 1%.
The door's still wide open for another Fed rate cut when they meet in December before the end of the year. And were they to do that, that would bring the Fed funds rate down into fractions.
That's economist Stuart Hoffman. Rates haven't been this low in more than 4 years.
Quick sports headline. The Phillies won the World Series last night after 46 hours of rain delay, but the Tampa Bay Rays went down. The Phillies won the series 4-1. We're talking about this election. How do you stop talking about it? It's been 2 years in the making. What are we going to do without it? Will we miss it? We need a slogan like Mike's here.
In order to change, you have to want change and accept change.
Thank you, Mike. You can tell us your slogan for this campaign at 877-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. And also, America's exit poll is open. There's early voting all over America. Polls say that by the time the polls open on the real election day, 30% of Americans may have already voted. We've already got like 9% turnout, according to some tracking.
And
polls.
We want to hear your story. Where'd you go? What were the lines like? What were the people like? And what'd you think of the overall process? Give us a call, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or drop us a note, mytakeatthetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. In a moment, we're going to discuss what appears to be the first signs of a prolonged shrinkage, at least some economists think so, in the U.S. economy. GDP numbers are out, and we're going to talk about that and other economic news. But we have on the line with us our undecided voter. Why do we say our undecided voter? Well, he's Andrew Kupka. He's from Atlanta, Georgia. We've talked with him a couple of times on the program. He is a registered Republican who voted for Obama in the presidential primary. Now he's undecided between McCain and Obama less than a week before the election. Andrew Kupka joins us once again this morning. Andrew, you are an undecided voter, and you have promised that when you made a decision, you're going to make it on our air. You're going to stick with that promise, right?
Yes, I will. Are you awake at 3 in the morning? Because I may have a vision at that point. And
oh,
have
I am
to call you.
So awake at 3 in the morning. Let me tell you how awake I am at 3
Sadly,
in the morning. You can definitely call me. Well, let's, you know, we're getting down to the wire here. You're looking at poll numbers. You're running out of time. You really have to make a decision here. How are you leaning? How are you feeling?
Well, I'm a little closer to making a decision, but haven't gotten there yet. I do like that McCain has a good job of bringing out the weaknesses, or at least perceived weaknesses, in Obama's economic policies with the sharing the wealth and all that connected to Joe the Plumber and whatnot. I still would rather hear, than McCain just make the jump and say, well, here's what I'm going to do. As opposed to what Obama's going to do, and this is what's going to help us get out of this economic mess. And I haven't heard that from him yet. So, yeah, I'm not ready to jump in. He's got to close.
Now, you're not going to do anything squirrely for me in the last couple of hours, like write in your uncle who's a banker or something like that. You're going to pretty much play this straight down the two-party line, right?
Probably. As I mentioned the other day, I considered maybe the Libertarian candidate. I have basically eliminated that from my mind. It'll be McCain or Obama, I'm pretty sure.
Why are you undecided? Just basically, why after 20 months are you still undecided?
Well, I guess it's just unique to this year where, you know, neither candidate grabbed me. I've been voting for 24 years now, and, you know, in any other year, I've had my mind made up long before this time. Huh. But this year, you know, John McCain, you know, as I mentioned, I am a conservative, so, you know, I don't hide that fact. And John McCain has just not grabbed me as a guy that could be president that I envision as being a great leader of this country.
One last question, and, you know, it's sort of an unusual question, but if John McCain were black, would you be more likely to vote for him?
No.
Now, does that mean you have a problem voting for Barack Obama because of his race?
Not at all.
So race is not an issue in the campaign at all for you?
Absolutely not. I don't live my life in that way.
Well, good stuff. Andrew Kupka, still undecided, still an American voter, and still in Atlanta, Georgia. Thank you very much, Andrew. We're going to talk to you again. He's going to make up his mind on this program.
He promised.
Right. He promised. New numbers on the economy today. The GDP, which measures the value of all goods and services produced in the U.S., shrank by 0.3%, a slightly smaller contraction than what analysts expected, and the markets are reacting positively to that. But it's still the worst quarter showing since 2001. Jobless claims also remain at the elevated level of 479,000, but it's unchanged from the previous week. Joining us to look at what these numbers say about the economy, whether it's Main Street or even more macro than that, is New York Times economics writer and our friend David Leonhardt. David joins us from Washington. Good morning, David.
Good morning.
The GDP number was negative, but the markets almost immediately reacted positively. I gather there was an expectation it would be much worse.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I've sort of tried to give up figuring out what the day-to-day movements in the markets mean at this point. But I think at this point, anything that's not worse than expected is almost by definition better than expected. And this was very close to expected and even slightly better. But if you look at it, I mean, it's really a good encapsulation of the economy's problems right now. Consumer spending fell over the course of a quarter for the first time in 17 years. And that's, in some ways, it's really an obituary for this whole debt-fueled era, because even through the last recession and through the stagnant income growth of the current decade, consumer spending continued to rise because we were going into debt in many cases to do it. And it looks like that's over.
It sounds, though, as though in these statistics, I mean, that 17-year milestone is really dramatic. And it sounds as though in household after household around the United States, couples are sitting down, families are sitting down and saying, we can't do this anymore. We got to take a different approach. And that's having a big effect on the economy.
I think that's right. And it's this really tricky situation. It's what Keynes called the paradox of thrift, because on the one hand, precisely what we need for a healthier long-run economy is people to save more. And yet we don't want them to do it too rapidly at this point, because if everyone suddenly started saving a lot more than they've been saving, consumer spending would fall really sharply, businesses would be caught unprepared, they would have to cut back quickly, they'd have to cut more jobs, and they'd have to cut bonuses and even more than they already are, and we could get into this really bad spiral.
So, David, this economic turmoil is obviously terrible timing as we head into the very busy holiday season, where so many stores and other retail outlets make their money for the year.
Yeah, that's right. It is. And the only way in which the timing is at all good is that the problems are coming to a head in a way that I think will make it very clear what the first priority of John McCain or Barack Obama needs to be, probably even before January 20th. And so we are at this moment where we're going to have in Washington a new administration that's going to be trying to figure out what to do, and they're really will be no debate about what it needs to be doing. But you're right, for businesses, retailers, this is not good timing.
Now, the commercial credit story, which was such a big issue, the commercial paper story, a couple of weeks ago, it seems to really have loosened up. And there are halting but steady, moves by the Fed and the U.S. Treasury into the financial market. And the LIBOR interest rate is down significantly this morning, which is an indication that lending is beginning. But I'm wondering if in this GDP number there's any indication of the pipeline of job losses, because that's really something we're going to be seeing over the next few months.
There isn't much of one. GDP is a little bit more backward-looking than, say, the jobs report. So the Friday after the election, which is a week from this Friday, we'll get a new jobs report that tells us what employers were doing in mid-October, roughly. This GDP report only goes through the end of September, and we actually already know what employers were doing in September. They were cutting jobs. But jobs are a trailing indicator, and so if you want to assume that it goes from consumer spending to jobs, you can then look at this report and you can say, oh, wow, consumer spending fell at 3%. That was its first decline since 1991, its worst decline since 1980 when the country was in a deep recession. You can look at that number and you can say, we have a very good idea what job growth or lack of job growth is going to be for the coming months,
wow.
And it's going to be significant, significant cuts.
Adora raises a really interesting point about the holiday season, that we may lose some retailers on this holiday season, just like some analysts have been saying as recently as a couple of days ago, we may lose one of the auto companies as this tsunami sweeps over some of these companies that are really cash-strapped. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think there are a lot of problems with economic crises, and one of them is that it takes some businesses that are weak for secular or structural reasons, and it can put them out of business. It can mean that they can never recover, and I think you'll see it with some retailers. I think you'll see it certainly with restaurants. I think you may well see it with auto companies, and in a subject that's close to my heart, I think we've already this week started to see it with some newspapers. At least they're very much changing their operations. The Christian Science Monitor canceled its print edition.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the ironies is with the fuel prices declining, though, the airlines may have dodged a bullet here.
Yeah. Although, boy, the airline business is, on the one hand, the airline business is just great. People can fly now in ways they never could 20 or 30 years ago. But from a corporate standpoint, it's just a total mess. And you wonder at what point can they figure out a way to get on more firm footing.
How can they take it? Those ups and downs must be a little more than stressful.
Well, thanks for deconstructing the numbers for us, as always.
Our
chief deconstructor, David Leonard, economics writer for The New York Times, talking to us from Washington. Thanks, David.
I'll talk to you soon.
And we're still talking about the election, its final week, and how you sum it up in a sentence or a phrase.
This is Monica Gore. My slogan for this year's campaign would be, the more things change, the more they stay the same.
I think that one's taken.
I think
somebody already did that.
Well, the sentiment has certainly been taken. We want to hear what you think. Sum it all up, these many months, these many hundreds of millions of dollars, these thousands of ads. How do you describe the 2008 presidential election? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. Some people would say it's been a grueling 2 years of presidential elections. Some would call it joyful and engaging. Well, will you look back at that time fondly? Well, Holly won't. Holly wrote to us on our website and she says, "Our long national nightmare is over." I suppose that will depend on who wins. Tell us your slogan for the past 2 years, or almost 2 years, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Martina just said, "Barack is the new black." That's slogan from her. We love all of these, and you can vote on them on our website. Anyway, we've noted repeatedly on this program that there is intense global interest in the American campaign, and we've talked with journalists who write for audiences not in America, and joining us now are Fernando Rodriguez, a reporter and columnist for the newspaper Folha de São Paulo, and Chidu Rajada is a foreign editor of the Times of India. They both join us from Washington, D.C. Fernando and Chidu, thanks so much for being with us.
Good to be with you, John. Hi.
Yeah, glad to be with you.
Chidu, let me begin with you. People in India have a lot of very pragmatic policy concerns uppermost in their minds, I suspect, as they look at this presidential campaign. There's been a lot of Indian-U.S. news in that relationship over the last few months.
Yeah, absolutely. At a very practical day-to-day level, there's the whole economic relationship, we live in a world where a lot of barriers have collapsed. So there's a movement of jobs back and forth. You guys would have heard of the term outsourcing or offshoring. Anybody who has any transaction, with any entity, you know that many of your calls go to India. So there's the whole job issue, and then there's the strategic issue. Particularly the war on terror, and India's always believed that. It's one of the primary victims, terrorism.
And you didn't even mention the nuclear exchange agreement, which is also an interesting policy development that's taken place during the last months of the Bush administration. Fernando, is there a policy that's driving the interest in Brazil, or is it more a question of race?
It's pretty much economic issues that drive the coverage of this election in Brazil most of the time, John. And Brazil has had so many economical ties with the United States because of the financial crisis. There's been so much interest in who is going to be the next president and how he will grapple with this crisis and how will he deal with allies like Brazil in the coming months and years. So that's one of the major issues being present in our coverage in Brazil.
Certainly in the United States, we're used to foreign journalists covering all aspects of our popular culture, and Hollywood gets as much coverage as anything in the United States in overseas newspapers. How do you cover the presidential campaign differently than you cover, say, the home life of Angelina Jolie, Fernando?
Well, it's not much different than the American media. We have five people here from our newspaper right now in the United States. Actually, it's only two who are based here permanently, but right now we have three more. And I am being one of them to help and cover the election. We go places like we follow McCain, we follow John McCain, we follow Barack Obama. We go to D.C., where I am right now, talking to authorities about the economic prospects for next year. We pretty much do a very similar job as the American media. Of course, not with the intensity of American newspapers, but we do have everyday articles about what's going on with the American presidential race.
Chidu Rajgada, does the readers of the Times of India have a strong preference one way or another in this race?
I would say so, although I think my sense is that worldwide, including India, there's a great deal of excitement about the candidature of Barack Obama. You know, this is an extraordinary election. At even in normal times, U.S. elections attract a lot of interest because, you know, its impact is felt throughout the world. The results are relevant throughout the world. This one is extraordinarily interesting simply because there's a minority candidate and also there's a woman on the ticket. I mean, unless you think this is something very flattering, I should say most of the world actually thinks, particularly India, we think the U.S. is behind the curve, that, you know, these kind of things have already happened, particularly in South Asia, if you've had minority candidates and women on the ticket. So it's generated a lot of interest, and particularly Obama's candidature, I'd say, has generated a lot of interest. People are really looking at the arrival of the full maturity of U.S. democracy.
Quickly, Chidu and Fernando, how are you handling the Palin story? Fernando, you begin. That's our last question.
We are covering Sarah Palin with not as much interest as the American media, because that's not big business in Brazil. But I'm just add to something that you've just mentioned. Like in Brazil, Brazil has the second largest black population in the world after Nigeria. And of course, Obama is being seen as the preferred candidate for most people. Actually, as a matter of fact, it was this poll last week showing that Obama gets the support of nearly 70% of the Brazilian voters, which is
That's interesting. Chidu, last question. Palin, is it a big deal in India?
Absolutely. A lot of interest, simply because, you know, in the South Asian context, almost every South Asian country has had a woman a leader, a woman executive. Yep. So they're all looking to how Palin will figure.
You're way ahead of us. Chidu Rajgada, foreign editor of the Times of India, and Fernando Rodriguez, a columnist for the newspaper Folha de São Paulo. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having me.
They both talked to us from Washington, D.C., part of our taking the pulse of foreign journalists as the campaign moves on. Now we have headlines from Femi. Okay.
Thank you very much. The time is coming up to 29 minutes past the hour, and it's a day for bailout plans. The Treasury and the FDIC is negotiating a plan to back up distressed mortgages for homeowners. It would protect millions of homes in danger of foreclosure. The plan, which would cost at least $40 billion, still faces some resistance from the White House. And the bailout for the U.S. banks is already in action. Treasury officials announced yesterday that the specific amounts of stock they bought from 9 major banks, and this first chunk of the bailout totaled $125 billion. A suicide bomber killed 5 people in a government building in Kabul earlier today. Taliban militants claim responsibility for the attack. The Afghan Information Minister, Abdul Karim Khurram, explains what happened.
The suicide attacker first of all fired at the police in front of the ministry building and killed one of them. Then he entered the first floor of the ministry, the media hall, and started firing there. But he could not go upstairs and blow himself up.
Suicide attacks are common around Afghanistan but have been relatively rare in the capital. And the Philadelphia Phillies are celebrating their first World Series win in almost 3 decades. The team finished last night's game over the Tampa Bay Rays in a 4-3 victory.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Markets are open on Wall Street, and the Dow Jones Industrial Average is surging ahead. More on that later. But consider, from Ron Paul to Reverend Wright to Sarah Palin, what a campaign it's been. 2 candidates, 2 years. The presidential election is almost over, and now it's just a matter of a few days. What's your slogan for the 08 campaign?
my slogan would be GOP Palin comparison. There you go, Palin comparison to Obama. Thank you very much. It's a great show.
We get it, Greg, but thanks for helping us out there.
Yeah.
It's your slogan, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or
it.
My take at thetakeaway.org.
Now we're going to continue our look at ballot initiatives across the country. And today we head to Nebraska and Initiative 424 that aims to ban affirmative action at public universities and all levels of state government. Colorado is also voting on a similar bill. It's a ban that businessman Ward Connerly has successfully pushed in six states, including California. Reporter Martin Wells joins us from Net Public Radio in Lincoln, Nebraska, for more. And good morning, Martin.
Good morning.
So it's likely to pass in Nebraska.
Well, it looks like it's going to at this point. I mean, polls seem to be showing that most voters are in favor of eliminating these so-called preferential treatment for minorities and women. So at this point, it's looking likely that it will pass.
So how does the initiative read, and practically speaking, what's the actual impact?
Well, the actual impact is one of the things that's really being debated right now, particularly when it comes to what's going to happen with university programs. People aren't really quite sure how exactly it is going to change that. Now, the folks at the University of Nebraska, Creighton University, and some others are really concerned that it's going to just keep them from recruiting as many minority students or minority faculty, while people who are in favor of the initiative say, well, you shouldn't be doing that anyway. If you want to have a level playing field, then you have to just start treating people equally.
Have the schools invoked the dreaded Cornhusker scenario here?
The Cornhusker scenario?
Well, in the sense that if the universities are hurt and can't recruit, it's going to affect the athletic programs in Nebraska, and those are some of the most popular institutions in the state.
Oh, I don't think it's going to have any impact on athletic recruiting. That's not something that that you need an affirmative action program for.
So how exactly would this initiative work? Nebraska is a predominantly white state, very, very small black and Hispanic population. How mm-hmm. would this really affect? Are there any numbers specifically that might change if it passes?
Well, that's also up for some debate. I mean, one of the things that the opponents will point out is that, you know, it's probably not going to have that much of an impact. You know, they're basically saying we don't have a problem, so this isn't going to do anything to change that.
Yeah, Martin, because I guess what I'm getting to is this really a symbolic vote, or is there some substantive, practical impact that's going to change the way that government does business or public universities are forced to do business? Because for the most part, across the country, affirmative action policies have been really watered down in a way mm-hmm. where they're not necessarily affecting the end result.
Right. Well, we don't have set-asides here in Nebraska or quotas.
Right.
But what the kind of things that they are doing is encouraging men to go into nursing programs, encouraging students from rural areas to come to the university, as well as trying to bring in more Hispanics and more African Americans. But yeah, you're right. I mean, the numbers aren't that big, so it's not like we're going to have a huge jump either way. But, you know, the people at the university will tell you that any loss is a setback. It's not like we have a huge minority student population.
Well, then, and they're looking politically at this, if it doesn't have that big of an impact, then there is a debate about what the consequence is going to be. Is there any impact politically? Is this ballot measure driving people to the polls?
Right, exactly.
That would favor some congressional seats that might otherwise be maybe a little more iffy.
You know, I don't think so. But I do see this playing out in the presidential race simply in the way the groups are presenting their arguments. I mean, on the Ward Connerly side of things, they'll tell you that, look, we're either going to have a black president or a woman vice president, and that means that we don't need these kinds of programs because everything is fine. When opponents will tell you, no, we got to the point where we are because we had these sorts of programs and we shouldn't be getting rid of them now.
Is it very controversial in Nebraska, and do you – expect that it will increase the number of people who turn in ballots this year?
I don't think that's going to be an issue that's really driving people to the polls. I think there is a number of issues that are already grabbing everybody's attention here. The presidential race, of course, the top one. But we also have a Senate race and some of the congressional seats up. There hasn't been a lot of talk about this lately, to tell you the truth, because other news items have kind of pushed it off the page. But, you know, we know just from the number of petitions that were turned in that there's a lot of support for this. We've had some polling that seems to show there's a lot of support for this. So it probably is going to go through.
Martin Wells, we thank you for joining us this morning.
My pleasure.
Martin Wells is a former news director for Net Public Radio in Nebraska. Now we turn to Femi Oke, who's got the latest headlines.
Thank you very much. The time is 21 minutes to the top of the hour. The American GDP shrank by 0.3% in the third quarter. That's the largest contraction since 2001. But it's not as bad as economists thought. They'd expected 0.5% of a drop. Now, investors don't seem to mind the news. The Dow Industrial Average was up around about 200 points at the open on Wall Street. That was just a few moments ago. Delta has bought Northwest to create the world's largest airline. They announced the nearly $3 billion deal yesterday. That's the second major airline merger this year. United and Continental joined forces this summer. Both the presidential candidates have been talking about race. John McCain says that only a tiny, tiny minority of people will let race affect their vote. And meanwhile, Barack Obama says he's not worried about the so-called Bradley effect. He expects white voters to turn out for him as well as black voters. The IMF is creating an emergency fund to help developing economies during the credit crisis. About $100 billion will be available to pre-approved countries, and this comes a day after the group promised Hungary $25 billion. The Colombian army has been murdering innocent civilians in order to up their military successes. An investigation into the disappearance of young people in Bogota has revealed that the military killed them and then pretended their bodies were rebel corpses. The plot was discovered after a government investigation. Michael Pollock from human rights group Amnesty International says it's about time that Colombia took the murders seriously.
The government, not only this government, but successive Colombian governments have repeatedly denied that a problem even existed. So at least an acknowledgement of the problem goes a long way to actually now taking measures to try and resolve this very serious problem indeed.
Michael Pollock, Amnesty International. And that's your news for now.
Thanks, Fem.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And less than a week from now, we got 5 days. This election's going to be over. We're going to be kicking back. We're going to be looking at what has just happened, and we're going to need a slogan. If not for now, for decades from now, when our kids ask us, you were there then, what was it like to be in the blank campaign? We need a slogan. Give us a call and tell us in just one sentence how you'd sum up the race.
Hi, this is Kevin Shufran from Stillwater, Oklahoma, and the year that I've got hope for America again.
We've been hearing from many of you very clever, insightful slogans. We want to hear from you, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. We're talking almost 2 years of campaigning, two candidates it's boiled down to. Emily sent us an email and says, is that all there is?
It takes a lot to impress Emily. And even though she was only on the trail for a couple of months, some of you thought Sarah Palin was the centerpiece of the whole campaign.
Jeff, I'm calling from Manhattan. My nickname for this election is the Thrilla from Wasilla.
And her running mate John McCain was on the minds of some of you. Samir writes on our website, thetakeaway.org, 2 years of Maverick.
Actually, that show was on the air for years.
Longer than two,
yeah, before it got canceled.
And of course, Obama was on the minds of some too.
Hi, my name is Amir Loomis. My slogan is, the backbone of this country went from picking cotton to now picking the president of the United States of America. Amen.
Hi, my name is Betsy. My slogan is, a battle between fear and hate, an abomination, and the hope and dreams of Obama nation. Oh,
Betsy. Whoa, Betsy. All right. Some of you took a slightly more dark view of the election. Roslyn writes on our website. Her slogan is 2008 presidential candidates, the scheme addicts. Nicole writes on our site, the more things change, the more they stay the same, but different. And here's another take.
This is Sean Bailey calling from Maplewood, New Jersey, and my slogan for the campaign is a nation of good people push too far.
Good morning. My name is Wes Gollum from Deerfield, New Hampshire, and my slogan or whatever for this election is it's latent racism versus latent sexism.
Ooh, live free or die.
And of course, there were some other people who were feeling very optimistic about this campaign. After 2 years, Phoebe had some good things to say.
My name is Phoebe. I have seen more people involved in this campaign for Barack Obama for president than ever before. I feel like it's my campaign, and I would call it the My America campaign.
Dad, what was it like to be alive during the My America campaign? I don't know, not quite, a little too generic, but I actually like,
no,
I like the idea. I like the idea.
I like that idea, and it was said with great earnestness.
Holly writes, our long national nightmare is over. And I suppose that depends on who wins, but, you know, we'll see what Holly thinks. Samir writes on our site, 2 years of Maverick. We just said that one.
Yeah, and Ed says, totally bushed. That's
Sandy on our side says, the old man and the sea of change. I like that one.
Yeah, but there's a pause there, John. The old man and the sea of change.
No, I got it. But thanks thanks for the help. I always could use some help. Here's one more from 8778MyTake.
Hi, this is Randy Hilst from Nantucket, Massachusetts. My slogan for this campaign is Dr. Strangelove versus Dr. Feelgood.
That's pretty darn good.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Yeah,
we want to know if
Dr.
you
Strangelove,
can outdo
really
any of these, 8778MyTake or MyTake at thetakeaway.org.
It's a public service we're doing and your chance to be a part of history. A slogan for this 20 months of campaigning that's been like no other campaign in memory. 8778MyTake, MyTake at thetakeaway.org. Thanks, guys.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Thursday, October 30th. Femi Okeh has just joined us, and she's got the latest headlines.
Thank you very much. The time is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. The coming election showdown in Israel is now official. The date was just set for February the 10th. This follows Foreign Minister Zippy Livni's inability to form a new government. She leads the ruling party. Polls show a tight race between her and hardliner Benjamin Netanyahu. Netanyahu. Yeah, you know what I'm trying to say.
Netanyahu.
Thank you very much. I got Zippy Livni and then couldn't get Benjamin's name. Sorry, Benjamin. Riot police surrounded the American embassy in Syria to protect it from tens of thousands of local protesters. They were protesting a U.S. attack on Syria near the Iraqi border. The demonstration ended peacefully. American troops were targeting what's thought to be the base of a smuggling network getting foreign fighters into Iraq. Syria's government wants an apology. The death toll in Pakistan's powerful quake is on the rise as victims fight injuries, hunger and brutal cold. More than 200 are now confirmed dead in the southwestern part of the region and some 15,000 are homeless in the frigid mountain areas. A small series of quakes near San Diego this morning. There were five quakes above magnitude 3. Scientists are watching to see if a stronger quake could actually follow. And new press reports out this morning say the Treasury Department and the FDIC are close to finishing an aid package for struggling homeowners. The plan will cost some $50 billion. And finally, we end with a little bit of voodoo. That's Jimi Hendrix playing Voodoo Child. He's going to be accompanying my final story. A French company has made a joke voodoo doll of President Sarkozy. It comes with instructions and pins to stick into the doll. The president didn't think the doll was funny and took the company to court to try and ban it. He said the doll infringed his exclusive rights to his own image. The judge in Paris said it was a matter of freedom of expression and humour, and did no harm to his dignity, the court case has helped turn the pincushion doll into an internet bestseller.
Wow, Femi. It's great you got Hendrix there. He doesn't do many public appearances.
He doesn't do many gigs, but he said for the takeaway he'd come out of retirement.
That's great. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
All right, so last night was the end of the World Series. The Phillies won. It was a 46-hour weather delay, but hey, the game is in the record books.
Phillies are world champions.
Even though I can't talk, it was really pretty exciting. I mean, when they began in the sixth inning, it was tied 2-2, then 3-3, but 4-3 was the final score. Joining us from San Francisco is Jeff Beresford Howe. Jeff, thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
First of all, the Phillies are very happy this morning, and I guess it was, in the very end there, kind of an exciting moment for baseball.
Well, yeah, the last three innings were the best three innings of the whole series.
Right.
Back and forth, some tension, some clutch performances, everything that the entire rest of the series lacked.
Do you think that was because it was so late, or the teams that got into the series? I mean, you have the Rays, who were very young and scrappy and inexperienced, and you had the Phillies that maybe there was a lot riding on this. You also had the terrible weather problems. What made it so bad? And you've trashed this series on our air quite a lot.
Yeah, you hated it, Jeff. Hated it.
Well, and I still do, and a couple of things. One is that the Rays played way, way over their head in the first two playoff series. And, you know, in baseball, that's how it works. These are gifted athletes, and you cannot sustain that level of performance for very long. Everybody comes back to earth. So that was part of it. The weather was definitely part of it, the late starting times. The bad umpiring, the questionable game management decisions by Major League Baseball. And last night we saw what you can only describe as managerial malpractice by Joe Maddon, the Tampa Bay manager. There were four big batters when the game resumed: Jenkins, Burrell, Victorino, and Feliz. And he had absolutely the wrong guy pitching to each one of those guys, and it cost Tampa Bay the game and a chance to go back to St. Petersburg and play more games.
It really was a puzzling decision why you would throw to that strength of the lineup, especially after they'd had so long to think about it, 46 hours or something?
Yeah, Madden made a big deal about how, you know, he had things wired and he had a secret plan, you know, kind of like Nixon getting out of Vietnam, but he couldn't tell anybody. And when the game resumed, it turned out his secret plan was to do everything he could to maximize the chances of a Phillies win.
The Phillies bullpen really stepped up here, and I guess that's the takeaway for next season. The Phillies really can go into next season feeling pretty confident. Would you agree?
Well, yes and no. I mean, Madsen's going to be a stud for a long time. J.C. Romero, though, has been up and down his whole career. He alternates fantastic years with miserable years. And Brad Lidge was perfect this year. Nobody stays perfect in baseball. Next year, one thing you can absolutely say with complete confidence is that Brad Lidge will not have the same year he had this year.
Well, is Brad Lidge stuck with the Phillies? Is he solid with the Phillies under contract? Because there's certainly a lot of big-name teams like the Yankees and certainly the Mets who are looking for closers.
Yeah, but there are a couple other closers on the market that are going to get more interest. The obvious one being Francisco Rodriguez of Anaheim, and Houston Street of the A's is going to be shopped around by Billy Bean as he continues his ongoing fire sale.
Was there an MVP of this series?
Well, they gave it to Cole Hamels, and he's as good a choice as anybody, right? He started two games, won the first game handily, and kept them in the second game despite horrific pitching conditions. So, sure, why not? But in the conventional, you know, guy coming in and taking over the series, no, there really wasn't.
And you know, finally on the series, and I'll move on to the NFL, but I don't know why I would want to talk to you. You're in San Francisco. Why would you care about the NFL, right? But before we get off of the series here, the Rays really can hold their heads high this season. I mean, as much as you've kind of trashed their play in the series, they really did have a spectacular season.
I mean, no one, no one a year ago today would have bet that this is the end, would have been the end result of the World Championship Series.
Well, yes, of course, that's exactly right. They had a magnificent season. They had a bunch of chances to fold during the season, key injuries, a lot of pressure from the Red Sox. They never did. They played magnificently against the White Sox. They played one of the best postseason series in years and beating the Red Sox. They have all this incredible young talent. I mean, they have seven or eight guys who are going to be major league level starting pitchers next year. There's no team in baseball that has half that many.
And they've totally rewritten the script for the American League East. It's no longer just a boring Red Sox-Yankees contest all the way through the season. The Rays are absolutely in there.
And hopefully, maybe that will bring in some fans next year, since they had trouble filling the seats for most of the season.
Yeah, the attendance, the way baseball works is the real shot in the arm for attendance comes the year after you win, not the year you're actually winning. So, yeah, their attendance will almost certainly go up next year.
So, parting shot on the NFL and the NBA. NBA started their season, of course, this week. Not much to report there. And the NFL, it looks like the Colts are completely out of it at this point. Any sort of assessment of where we are?
Well, the thing that struck me about the NBA, to go back to that for just a second, is Greg Oden. I mean, kid.
Exactly.
He sits out all year last year, comes out ready to go. You know, the Trailblazers, people are talking about them as a team that can really move up this year. And the first thing that happens is, boom, he's out again.
Within minutes.
Yeah, it's just, you know, he's a good kid, and it just makes you feel sorry for him, and it's just a bad situation.
NFL, Colts, can they come back?
No. Done.
All right. Very good. Jeff Beresford Howe, a man of few words out there
concise
in San Francisco.
Ending.
The dark NFL crater, we call San Francisco. Jeff, thanks so much for joining
us.
It's
so brutal out here.
Talking all things sports, he is a freelance sports writer, Jeff Beresford Howe. And Nora, take us out.
And, of course, we're talking about the election. We're trying to figure out the one sentence or the one phrase that just sums up what this cycle has been about, the months and the primaries and the record turnouts and record raising money. How do you sum it all up?
The lead up to the beat up.
World without end.
The thriller from Wasilla.
Dr. Strangelove versus Dr. Feelgood.
The wait for 08.
The My America campaign.
A nation of good people pushed too far.
The year that I got hope for America again.
A nation of people pushed too far. I like that. There's only one correct answer, and if you get it, you have to send it to us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. But really, it's the diversity of voices that we love.
Oh, absolutely, or what's most important. And you can vote on the campaign slogan that you think best fits the 2008 presidential election. You can go to our website at vote2008.thetakeaway.org. And here's your takeaway.
It's this really tricky situation. It's what Keynes called the paradox of thrift. Precisely what we need for a healthier long-run economy is people to save more.
That's New York Times' David Leonhardt.
If you miss anything, it's all on our website at thetakeaway.org. You can take our podcast to go each morning on iTunes. And you better start subscribing because we've got a lot of extra coverage coming up starting the morning of Election Day.
I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And my slogan is, this is The Takeaway.
That's mine too.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.